This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. Pirates. This podcast is about pirates. 16 men, dead men's chest, yo-ho-ho, bottle of rum, that kind of thing. Pirates are the criminals that attack a supply chain. We have them on the Straits of Malacca, in the streets of New Jersey, and on the servers of the Internet. This podcast is entitled Long John Silver and the Digital Jolly Roger. Even though Eddie's food cart prominently displays a city's vendor's license as well as a health certificate, I'm always hesitant to purchase anything from it. You just don't know where his food has been. Sure, most everything is sold in a sealed package, but many of these packages look as if they were snatched from the back of a pickup truck. Still, Eddie serves a good cup of coffee, and he has a loyal customer base. Many of these customers are the limo drivers who are waiting for their employers to finish their power lunches at the nearby Costozzi's restaurant. I was chatting with Eddie recently when he suddenly looked at me and asked, "Do you need some software?" "Excuse me?" I asked. It never occurred to me that Eddie might be doing some computer system design work in his spare time. "I was just wondering if you needed some software," he continued, "because you look like the sort of guy who might. And I know a guy up in Columbia Heights who can get it for you real cheap." Perhaps it was neither the time nor the place to be inquisitive, but I could not resist asking, "Is this the real stuff, or is it pirated?" Eddie grinned in a way that almost made me believe he might be a survivor of the golden age of Caribbean buccaneers. Then he gave me a quick description of how the copy protections of a major software vendor could be easily circumvented. He spoke as if every 12-year-old shared this knowledge. "The software works perfectly well," he added. "There are a few parts of the program that don't work, and you can only save your data in the .rbd format, whatever that is. But the program only costs $10. So Eddie belongs to a pirate gang, I thought, as I declined his offer most politely. It's a strange business to be operating on one of the city's busiest street corners. But the world is a confusing place. He has operated his food cart there for years, despite Costozzi's efforts to stop him. Likewise, I suspect that he'll be able to peddle his software for years to come, no matter what the software giants attempt to do. Of course, Eddie's cart is only a teeny part of the global software piracy. The Software and Information Industry Association estimates that the software industry itself lost $28 billion to pirates last year. A report from a second group, the Business Software Alliance, notes that if you go across the globe, $2 is spent in illegal software for every dollar that is racked up in legitimate sales. In some countries, such as, well, Albania and, of course, Zimbabwe, virtually all software is pirated. In several very big markets, most notably those of Russia and China, more than 80% of all software is illegal. Software piracy, like the classic piracy of the 17th and 18th centuries, is a crime against the distribution network. The Caribbean pirates played on the wealthy but fragile transportation route that connected Spain to its colonies in Central and South America. The pirates extracted tremendous wealth from this vital link, which carried weapons and manufactured goods to the colonies and returned millions of silver and gold coins to Spain. These pirates operated freely in the region until the European powers took deliberate and organized steps to eliminate their bases of operation. The growth of the British Navy in the 17th century greatly reduced piracy in the region. Nevertheless, pirates vanished from the Caribbean only when the region ceased to host an important distribution network. Compared to their ocean-going counterparts, the software pirates will be harder to eliminate, as the information industry has given them a technology that lets them hide their activities far better than William Kidd or Henry Morgan could hide their ships. The struggle against piracy will be one of the defining periods of the information age. It will test the software industry's ability to project its power, to control the actions of reclusive pirates in distant lands. Just as Spain began to falter when it lost access to the mineral wealth of the Americas, this industry may find itself in deep waters should it lose access to the rich revenue streams that it currently enjoys. Like so many problems of this world, software piracy has existed almost as long as software itself. One of the early computer pioneers, Calvin Moores, noted that software markets of his era were, as he said, characterized by a kind of anarchic morality in which all software is fair game for outright ripoff. Then, as now, many considered the problem to be one of ethics. They claimed that people stole software because they didn't know any better. One educator wrote, "Computer software and data are intellectual property. The problems start when people cannot, or will not, make the mental transition from physical to intellectual property." Yet, piracy is not merely a failure to recognize right from wrong. Moores noted that the early pirates were, as he said, not only individuals. Among them, in fact, are a few of our largest and most highly respected corporations. Companies have many reasons to encourage piracy, reasons that can cause them to take actions that they know to be illegal. In a piracy case of the mid-1980s, two different firms copied a well-known piece of system software and marketed it as their own work. At first, neither of these firms acknowledged that they had done anything wrong. Instead, they claimed that they were merely making shrewd, though admittedly aggressive, business decisions. A friend of mine, who worked on the software before it was stolen, tried as hard as he could to resolve the problem, and eventually decided to approach it as a missionary among the lost souls, just as the European churches sent emissaries to convince pirates of the errors of their way. This friend tried to stop the piracy by organizing a conference for all parties to the complaint. At this conference, they not only discussed the contractual relationships among them, they also looked at the foundations of morals. Sabers and cutlasses were to be left at the door. In addition to the usual round of lawyers and principals and mediators, this conference included a Protestant minister and a Buddhist monk to lead the discussion. At the meeting, one of the firms had a change of heart. Light shone from the heavens, scales fell from their eyes, and all there recognized the evil of their ways. They immediately repented and tried to make good for what they had done. The other firm, however, didn't react in quite the same way. They found the talk of right and wrong interesting in an abstract kind of intellectual way, but they still insisted that they behaved by the rules of the market. In the end, their defense was no better than the claim that pirates make the market more efficient by redistributing surplus wealth. The officers of that withholding corporation, that last group, ended their days in jail, guilty of theft of software on the high seas. Back in that 17th century time of Caribbean piracy, the most effective pirates were not the lone ships preying upon the Spanish, but national pirates, privateers, which were sanctioned by the United Kingdom or by the Netherlands to attack foreign commerce. The most famous of these privateers were the buccaneers, the Brethren of the Coast. One historian noted that they formed a seafaring republic, which did as much as any nation to erode the Spanish dominion over the New World. To fend against these privateers and buccaneers, The Spanish had to build a substantial infrastructure in the region. They created a navy, a string of heavily armed forts, a communication link that took messages from place to place to keep all those residents informed of the actions of the area. The buccaneers of software are not from the lowlands of Europe or from isolated island kingdoms in the North Sea, but from the lands of East Asia. One observer of this phenomena has noted that American companies are losing many millions of dollars in potential business in China because software is widely pirated there. The U.S. government has charged that this piracy required very concerted efforts by Chinese engineers and hence pointed to a very serious decision which must have been made at the highest level in the Chinese ministries, at the Chinese research institutes, and in the Chinese state-run organizations to acquire U.S. software. The software industry responded to the evidence of national piracy by strengthening its global defense infrastructure. The fortresses of the software distribution routes are not made of stone and steel, but copyright standards, trade agreements, and treaties to share the burden of policing the world computers. This defensive effort has been only marginally successful. Some of the biggest national markets outside the U.S., notably those of China and Russia, have seen only small reduction in piracy. The piracy rate in China has fallen from a high of 92% to 82%. The rate in Russia has dropped slightly less, from 87% to a flat 80%. The best news from these markets is the fact that they're expanding so rapidly that the revenue from legitimate products is still growing substantially. The Business Software Alliance has noted that in China, this legitimate revenue increased 88% from 2005 to 2006. The Caribbean pirateers and buccaneers were replaced eventually by individual pirates, crews that mutinied against their captains and preyed upon the Spanish trade. Their ships were harder to eradicate because they found ample hiding places on isolated islands or often in the small bays of the North American continent. The modern counterparts of the lone pirate ship are those individual pirates who distribute software on peer-to-peer networks or offer it for sale in small stores or, occasionally, at food carts on street corners. In some regions, the small pirate distribution networks are actually far stronger and, in some ways, far more effective than legitimate distribution channels. A friend of mine, Anna, who has lived in distant lands, once told me that these software pirates are the only way that you can keep your network operating in some parts of the world. The stuff that you buy at the pirate computer store, she says, comes with a special disk that you load first. This prevents what she calls the annoying little registration thingy from coming up. Last I saw Anna, she had just returned to the U.S. after working for 2 years in Central Asia. I was initially inclined to discount her claims, as she comes from the generation that learned about electronic music through the illegal file-sharing networks of the 1990s. However, she quickly convinced me otherwise. Central Asia is a very poor place, she said, and so it is the remainder sale for software from all over the world. If you buy movies, for example, they might come from the U.S., they might come from Australia, they might come from Europe, they might come from Hong Kong. So, I asked, why does that encourage piracy? Each of these legal movies has a digital code, she said, that says where it's from. If you try to play that movie with legitimate software, the computer will eventually decide that you're in some specific part of the world, and it will prevent you from playing anything from any other region. She went on. The only way to fix the problem is to buy bootlegged DVD software for a buck. When the pirates make the DVD, they strip out the security, and they also remove the code that sets the region. If you don't use that, you'll eventually have a computer that can only play films that were marketed for Micronesia. If we follow the strategy that was used against the 17th century pirates, we would attempt to reduce software piracies in distant markets by strengthening the distribution network, making it easier to buy software at a distance, and easier to track the usage of software in remote places. Some authors suggest marking each copy of software so that it could be tracked through the network. Such technologies, claim these experts, would dissuade the pirate by increasing the likelihood of being caught. With the difficulties of enforcing law at a distance, it seems unlikely that technology, by itself, will entirely prevent piracy. Anna likes to remind me that some of her pirated software uses the Interpol anti-piracy screen as the background to the main menu. It's my favorite part, she says, the digital Jolly Roger. It's the mark of the modern pirate, stolen from the anti-piracy forces. In looking for a clear, unified solution to software piracy, a few authors have suggested deploying an economic policy against stolen software. It's an obvious solution for an industry that has so thoroughly championed the power of the market. Most of the highest piracy rates are in countries that are poor, countries that have no indigenous software industry, countries that cannot easily enforce national copyright standards. In such countries, a pair of economists have argued that focusing purely on enforcing intellectual property rights will have limited success. Legislative and educational weapons may win a few battles, but the overall war against piracy cannot be won without addressing the current draconian pricing policies. These economists have concluded that we can reduce the piracy rate in such countries only by making the price of legitimate software competitive with the price paid for pirated software. I suspect we probably won't eliminate software pirates in the near future. Spain struggled with them for decades. We probably won't do it with a single strategy. We don't have the technical, financial, or political resources to do anything more than whittle away at that basic piracy rate. 92%, 87%, 80%, maybe slide it into the 70s. Furthermore, some legitimate firms have much to gain from illegitimate software. Piracy can reduce your costs, can keep a competitor out of the marketplace, increase the acceptance of certain ideas, build the demand for products related to your software. Finally, we must admit, the line between aggressive capitalism and organized crime can be thin and ill-defined at times. Piracy to one person can be a low-cost supply opportunity to another. Aggressive pricing can be a means of stopping a black market or a way to undercut a legitimate competitor. Accurate product tracking can strengthen a distribution network or can invade your privacy. Should the software industry succeed in reducing piracy, it will be able to claim that it has spread its business culture and its ethics to every corner of the globe, an accomplishment that was denied the Spanish Empire in the 17th century. If we draw near to that point, we might find that we start to romanticize the software pirates, just as we have romanticized the pirates of the Caribbean. These pirates have been made into daring individuals through the writings of Daniel Defoe, Lord Byron, Robert Louis Stevenson. We have come to view them as people who expressed their own individuality in the face of an oppressive colonial regime. For the moment, we still tend to view pirates as petty thieves, no matter how large an operation they might run. If we come to feel that our lives are a little too much under the control of Redmond or Silicon Valley or some other technological capital, we might come to give our pirates a little more heroic light, and we could discover, like the Spaniards of the 18th century, that the future better remembers us for our piracy than for our admirals of industry, for the digital Jolly Roger, rather than the flags of all the software corporations put together. You've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay published in the March 2008 issue of Computer, a magazine that is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. To find information about Computer, just click on the tab that says Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.